Dateline Washington, Monday, May 25th, 2009. Hello again and happy Memorial Day from the nation's capital. I'm Greg Corumbus. In this edition, a conversation with retired U.S. Air Force General and former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers. He's also the author of the new book, Eyes on the Horizon. We'll get his inside analysis of the operations in both Iraq and Afghanistan, how they got going, and his analysis of where they stand today. We'll also get the General's appreciation for the soldiers of every American generation. Also in this edition, Horse Soldiers. Doug Stanton is here to discuss his new book on the amazing work of the U.S. Special Forces in the early days of fighting in Afghanistan. Plus, American Heroes. Retired Marine Colonel Ollie North is with us to discuss his new book, chronicling the heroes in this fight against radical Islam. And of course, we'll wrap up the hour with some important thoughts as we recognize those who have given their lives in service to this nation. All of that is straight ahead in this special hour of Dateline Washington. We begin with General Myers, and we begin right now. My first guest in this edition is retired U.S. Air Force General Richard Myers, who also served this nation as Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2001 to 2005. He's also the author of the brand new book, Eyes on the Horizon, Serving on the Front Lines of National Security. And General Myers, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the program.
Hey, Greg, it's great to be on your program. Thank you very much.
You certainly came into office less than a month after 9/11. At the time that you were first nominated, the big focus was on reforming the military, bringing it into the 21st century. And literally, as you were on Capitol Hill meeting with senators about the confirmation process, you learned about 9/11. How radically did that change your job over the next 4 years?
Well, I think it changed it totally. I mean, 9/11 defined my tenure as chairman. As you said, I came in 1 October, 20 days after 9/11, and then for the next 4 years, we were busy in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then trying to come up with a strategy that would defeat the al-Qaeda and the violent extremists overall, all around the globe. It was a very different, a very unique time in our national security history, and that's one of the things that prompted me to write the book.
One of the things you also talk about in the book is the fact that a war strategy was necessary on a much shorter timetable than anyone would have hoped would be necessary. What were the key processes in moving forward and putting together a cohesive strategy, literally, to actually begin military operations less than a month after the attacks here?
We were really scrambling, as you might imagine. And once it was determined, which was very quickly, that indeed al-Qaeda had perpetrated the attack and that they lived and trained in to a large extent in Afghanistan, it was pretty clear we had to go to Afghanistan. Bear in mind, Afghanistan's a landlocked country, and we didn't have many friendly nations in the country, at least at that point, that were going to be willing to provide us with logistics bases. So how do you go to a landlocked country and make it different than last time? Not cruise missile strikes, but put boots on the ground and try to have some real effect on the al-Qaeda and of course, consequently, the Taliban, who were ruling Afghanistan at the time. So it required a whole new way of thinking.
Talk about the teamwork. You mentioned the meeting up at Camp David the weekend after 9/11, and obviously a lot of collaboration necessary going forward. What were the best working relationships that you had, and how did that impact our military efforts in a positive way?
Well, I think the best would be with the intelligence community. I think, take Afghanistan, for example, that going into Afghanistan, the CIA had operatives and people that knew some of the ground and some of the actors there. And so the partnership between the Department of Defense and between the CIA was really important to be successful in Afghanistan. And I would say that partnership was something that Secretary Rumsfeld and I stressed throughout our tenures, was to make sure we had very close relationship with the CIA, but also the State Department and the other departments and agencies of our government, because as I try to point out in the book, that it's not just a military instrument of power that's needed if you're going to deal with violent extremism. It's also the other instruments of power, the political diplomacy piece, economic piece, informational piece, and even an educational piece that the military is not best suited to carry out.
General, obviously the success of the military operation in Afghanistan was abundantly clear by the end of 2001, just a couple months after the major operations started there. And by the end of 2001, the Taliban was on the run. Obviously, now we see that it's reconstituted itself to some extent, and it's become the major focus of the war on terror again. Does that surprise you, or do you believe you pretty much had them dead to rights at that point?
These violent extremists, of which the Taliban are one example, the al-Qaeda are another example, they're going to be opportunistic. And if you have fairly weak governments, then they'll try to rise again. So I think we've seen a little of that in Afghanistan, certainly in Pakistan, where the Taliban are making a lot of noise right now, currently. These are places where the central governments perhaps aren't bringing all the services they should to all the citizens of those countries. So it's easy for an extremist group to go in and start to delegitimize those governments. So the one thing we have to make sure of, and I think the current administration has mentioned this, they have to try to strengthen the central government in Afghanistan and the central government and support the central government in Pakistan, because if they're weak, then the violent extremists have they have carte blanche to go try to get the people on their side and not on the government side.
The president made it very clear just days after 9/11, of course, that those who harbor terrorists, fund terrorists, side with the terrorists, will be considered in league with the terrorists. And, of course, about a year later, we were moving closer to a conflict with Saddam Hussein's Iraq because of his failure to comply with United Nations resolutions. His compliance with inspections was limited at best. At what point did you begin to believe that, yes, in fact, there would be a military operation in Iraq? And how difficult was that plan to put together?
Well, the president didn't decide until in 2003. But as we put the plan, we worked for over a year on trying to put a plan together for Iraq. We were directed to do that, and we did it. And it was a very comprehensive plan and continually refined. I mean, we took a year. General Franks at Central Command was the one responsible for doing the planning, and the Joint Chiefs and, of course, the Secretary Rumsfeld's office were responsible for the oversight and for making recommendations to the president in the end. And so we worked on that plan for over a year, and it was there was a lot of detail gone over, I can guarantee you.
General, you mentioned President Bush giving the order. A lot of people have their own impression of the president and his policies, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq. You got the chance to obviously work with him behind closed doors, see the way he went through his decision-making processes. What sticks in your mind about his leadership during a time of war?
I'll give you two things. One is an example, or a little quote I put in the book. The first National Security Council meeting after 9/11, when the president had us all gathered together, he said, well, we don't know what we're going to have to do to make ourselves more secure. We don't know. This is well before we decided to go into Afghanistan or anything like that. But he says, I suspect that we're going to do some things that will be unpopular with the people. And if that means this is a one-term presidency, then so be it. So he was prepared to do the right thing. And the consequences could have been a one-term presidency. He was prepared for that as well. So the other thing I would mention is he, in my view, followed his brain and his heart in terms of trying to do what was best for this country. And he was not concerned with what the polls said or other people said. He would listen to all the input, and then he would make his decision based on what he thought was right for the United States of America.
How surprised were you and other Pentagon officials at the aftermath of the very successful major combat operations in Iraq in terms of the insurgency and so forth? And that was still very much an issue at the time that you left your position. Ultimately, the surge in the counterinsurgency strategy has proven to work quite effectively. What did you make of the instability, and why do you think the final strategy has been more effective?
Well, I think initially Iraq was very quiet. And one of the assumptions was Iraqis would want to get right around to the business of governing their own country. And that was a bad assumption. I'm not sure all of us believe that assumption. So we had to be flexible in terms of how we responded to things. Our first response, since this country was quiet, we put a civilian in charge of the provisional authority. And then it took a long time, and in an insidious way, for this the insurgency to build up. By the time I left office, though, even though the insurgency was still obviously very evident because we were losing, you know, lots of good coalition and U.S. Forces to wounds or being killed by these insurgents, nevertheless, we had a constitution that the people voted on, risked their lives to vote on. I left office just before the government was established. But I'd say there was a lot of progress in that time frame, despite the fact the insurgency was going on. The people were voting. We had they had their constitution. Then the bombing of the mosque in Samarra in February of 2006 was a turning point in terms of trying to stir up the sectarian violence. And it was that sectarian violence between 2006 and 2007 that got out of hand, that led to the surge then, which lasted actually for actually a very short time. But it was necessary to bring the sectarian violence under control. And the strategy change there was also important. That was protecting the Iraqi people from themselves, in a sense. And so You know, we've seen it ebb and flow, and I think it's on a good track now. Everybody seems to say it's on a good track, although it's not that it's not reversible. There's a lot of work to do in Iraq, but I think the people I know from Iraq, the people I've met, the people I still talk to in Iraq, they're very enthusiastic about trying to make a country that's much better off without Saddam than with Saddam.
In terms of Iran, one of the things that got covered to some extent, but not real consistently, was their efforts, and I guess really ongoing efforts to this day, to destabilize the new government in Iraq. How big of a challenge was that for you?
That was a big challenge. I think it's still a challenge. As everybody knows, the United States has very little leverage over Iran. And while I was chairman, we had good evidence, that the hard evidence that Iran was training and providing weapons to particularly the Shia militias who were keeping things stirred up. That's been somewhat ameliorated by the fact that the political process has sort of defanged the militias for the time being. But I think Iran will be opportunistic. I think they'll look for ways to continue to try to influence events inside Iraq. Iraqis, on the other hand, they're Iraqis first. They're not Persian. They have their own intense pride, national pride. And so I see the attempts to influence, but I think as long as the central government remains strong, as long as the people feel connected to that central government, that Iran will not be able to play a major role, although they will never give up, because the last thing they want to see, of course, is a stable democracy on their border. It's against what the Ayatollahs in Iran think is the way to govern, and that is through a more extreme religious view.
Retired Air Force General Richard Myers, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The book is Eyes on the Horizon. When we come back on this special Memorial Day edition of Dateline Washington, we'll get the general's thoughts on what makes the American service member so special.